So in previous weeks, we've looked at an overall picture of who the Quakers are and where we find them around the world. We then had a fairly intense canter through the history of Quakerism and the different traditions. And then in week three, we looked at, in particular, at the detail of Quaker worship and the theology behind the silence that Quaker worship is characterized by, and this open worship, this ability, this space in which to encounter God directly. And in the week, the last talk we had, it was then on what Quakers believe, both historically and in the present day. So, okay. So what I want to look at this evening is the very particular attitude that Quakers have to theology and language. And whilst this is an introductory series, and you might not expect to have such a sort of detailed or particular talk on this aspect, it is very characteristic of Friends, and is a particular hallmark of how they've approached their faith over the centuries. And as usual, what we'll do is we'll look at first at the early Friends, and then we'll look at the way that the present-day traditions, the evangelical Friends, the conservative Friends, and the liberal Friends, have been innovative in a sense, or have changed things over time. So, just to recap, early Friends adopted this worship method based in silence, possibly borrowed from the Seekers, certainly with reference to Revelation 8:1 and the half an hour of silence in heaven after the breaking of the seventh seal. Basically, Quakers were very critical of the outward, whether that was in terms of the form of worship or in terms of carnal talk or fleshly speaking, idle words. There was this sense that sort of natural language had come into being at Babel and was not part of the Edenic state, the Garden of Eden state that Quakers had returned to. There, they felt in this special place that they'd been taken to, they could comprehend God without any need for outward words. You just didn't need outward language. And you may remember the quote a few weeks ago of this early Friend in worship saying, "Not a word was spoken, but we knew that God was master of that assembly." So a very strong, clear experience without any words being necessary. So that's very important. And again, from Jeremiah, it's a quote reference I've given before, there's this idea of the inward covenant, and this idea that the new covenant is written on your heart. You don't even need to ask your neighbor, "Well, where is God?" because you know now where God is through this inward experience. So, basically, Quakers interiorize everything. So, even their sense of the second coming is not about an outward second coming, but an inward encounter. And then what's then important is that you prepare yourself for this direct encounter without any need for outward help. So that's partly what silent worship is about. It's about closing down your worldly self, the old self, and opening yourself up to God. And ultimately, it's a means to the experience of God, and as also a consequence. Once you've experienced God, where else to go but back into that silence, that deep place of encounter? So what we find is silence on both sides of the experience of God. Where Quakers do use, I mean, they don't become Trappists or a silent order or anything like that. I mean, they actually talk quite a lot and publish quite a lot as well. But what they're advocating through words is actually silence, and a silencing of the self. So an early Quaker tract here from George Fox: "Now thou must die in the silence to the fleshly wisdom, knowledge, reason, and understanding. Keep to that of God in you, which will lead you up to God when you are still from your own thoughts and imaginations and desires and counsels of your own hearts. When you stand single from all these, waiting upon the Lord, your strength is renewed. So in other words, it's about removing yourself from the world, from the worldly part of yourself, thoughts and imaginations, desires and counsels. And when people spoke in worship, what gets called vocal ministry, which anyone was able to do, it was an open form of worship, a free ministry, everyone was spiritually equal, so anyone may speak into the silence. But the point of words in silence is to deepen the silence, is to take people further into this inward experience. So in other words, words add to the silence, take people into the silence. And any speech needed to come out of that inward place. So, there's a story of George Fox at Preston Patrick with some of his new converts who had been seekers, and they were having a meeting which was similar to the ones they'd had before, except in the previous ones, a seeker minister would get up and say something inspiring quite early on. And Fox is just sitting there and waiting, and all these other people have organized a meeting and getting very anxious. You know, is he not going to say something? We've gathered all these people together and he's not saying anything. And finally, but after a very long time, he gets up. Because he only speaks when he's led to speak by God. Basically, we have a sense where the speaker is passive and God's words come through the person to the meeting. So the speaker is a channel for the word of God. And here, Richard Farnsworth in 1663, the Lord is the teacher of his people and he may be the speaker in them and through them. So also the talk that people do give, the way they do break the silence, is come from beyond the person that's doing the talking. It's not them that's doing the talking. And I did mention that in the 18th and 19th century, and in fact I heard last week that this was happening even through to the 1940s, people would sometimes minister in a voice different from their own, a sort of nasal tone or a sing-song chant to differentiate between their own voice, their own personhood, as it were, and God speaking through them. So, once you're out of worship, Quakers also don't go into sort of loose talk or excess talk. So, well known for not saying sort of good morning and these sorts of things. You know, lots of forms of basic etiquette are abandoned by early friends. They're trying to bring the whole of their lives under the guidance of God. And sort of just small talk is not part of what God would want, according to these friends. So, they are obviously constructing a theology around this experience that they have in the silence. This experience of God breaking into their lives, of being continually with them. It's that experience which basically underpins their critique of other churches. They look at these other churches which are so filled with forms and words that how can anyone die to the self and be open to this encounter? As Fox said, he was, you know, everyone was shut up in unbelief as he had been. And he basically needed to get to a very low, broken state in order to have this insight, to have this experience. Only the direct experience of Christ can release the believer from their captivity. So everyone's shut up, imprisoned, as it were, but can be freed. And when Margaret Fell becomes a Quaker, she becomes one of the leading Quakers in the 1650s and 1660s, based up in Ulverston. Fox is speaking in Ulverston Parish Church. He's interrupted the minister. And he's asking people, you know, he says, you will say Christ said this and the apostles say this, but what canst thou say? Art thou a child of the light and hast walked in the light? And what thou speakest, is it inwardly from God? So is your theology about profession without possession? Do you just say the words but don't really own them, don't really inhabit them? And for Margaret Fell, she wrote, this opened me so that it cut me to the heart. And then I saw clearly we were all wrong. And I sat down in my pew again and cried, bitterly, "We are all thieves. We are all thieves. We've taken the scriptures in words and know nothing of them in ourselves. I saw it was the truth and I could not deny it." So there's this sense that amongst all the words that all the churches are, professing, they're not possessing this new truth, this new exciting truth that Quakers have found. And of course, the point for Friends is then to spread this word. Once it's revealed to them, they of course have to share that, because everyone is shut up in unbelief or a thief, basically, according to this early Quaker thinking. So very strongly critical of the outward, strongly critical of empty theology and empty forms. So, as I said, it doesn't turn them into a silent order, but it turns them into one that's very concerned with authenticity. Is what you say authentic? Is it coming from the right place? And part of the critique has been creeds, creedal statements of belief. So traditionally, Friends have been very critical of creedal statements of belief that are either just formulaic or appear inauthentic. You can just, we'll come back to that a little later. Now, that's the early Quaker position. And, of course, over time, as with everything else, tradition changes tradition. So what we find today is an evangelical Quaker tradition, the majority of Quakers in the world, fairly close to the Protestant mainstream, except still this emphasis on direct encounter, priesthood of all believers, spiritual equality of everybody, and peace witness. But in many ways, having abandoned the Quaker critique of outward forms, it's in that tradition that we will now find pastors and singing and an order of worship. They will potentially celebrate Christmas and Easter and have worship that matches up with the Christian calendar. In 1887, these yearly meetings adopted a declaration of faith, which isn't a creed, but it does look rather like one. It starts off with, "We believe in one God," and carries on like this. So in other words, a group, a tradition that is not concerned with a critique of outward words, is not concerned with, is concerned, of course, with inauthentic theology, but feels that it's found it and can operate at quite a degree of certainty around that, as early Friends did. But certainly not concerned about noise and words in worship. So, in fact, where some of these churches have a period of open worship, they're absolutely filled with words. Lots of people wanting to pray and testify out loud. And it's actually quite, in some of them, it's quite difficult to find any silence. So in a sense, it looks very different to the early Quaker tradition. The conservative Friends, conserving the tradition, quite small in number, but a very important tradition. They say, there's a quote here from one of their groups, "As Friends, so affirm and seek an ever more perfect openness to God's guidance in their daily lives. They have found it preferable to offer no allegiance to doctrine, dogma, or creed." So the authentic approach means you don't then sign up to any set form of theology. Although, of course, that itself is a theological statement. So. Now, I want to focus mostly today on the liberal tradition, because it's the liberal Friends that we find in Britain today, and these are the kinds of Quakers that you'll find if you go into one of the 500 meeting houses around Britain. What's happened in the liberal tradition is that a caution over speech and theology has been, or a caution over speech and empty theology has been turned into a caution over theology in general and theological speech in general. And we'll come back to that in a minute. One of the ways of thinking about these three traditions, evangelical, conservative, and liberal, is to look at it in terms of realism. And I don't want to get too technical here, but we can say that evangelical and conservative friends are realist in their theology. I'll say what these mean in a minute. And that liberal friends are semi-realist or non-realist. This all sounds a bit weird. Do we need this at 6:15 on a Wednesday afternoon? So, but it's quite straightforward in a way. Realist just means that God is real and what you say about God is true and real. That's realist. Basically, you can say true things about the true God. Okay? So that would be an accurate description of evangelical and conservative friends. They can say things that are true about God, which they know to be real. So. Now, and it's not, I mean, that's a position that's probably shared by most religious groups, actually. And it's just that liberal friends, the kinds of Quakers we find in Britain, are a little bit different. And that's partly why they're so interesting. So liberal friends are non-realist or semi-realist. Well, non-realist, which is a minority position in amongst British friends, but non-realist says that when we talk about God, we're not referring to anything real. And that's, in other words, God is not real or does not exist beyond our imagination. And so one of the leading authors of the non-realist school, I mean, if you're familiar with theology, Don Cupid is a non-realist. But within Quaker circles, David Bolton is a well-known non-realist. And he said, from this viewpoint, God is understood not as a real person or a power or an entity, but as a symbol or an idea. God is a fiction. That's the non-realist position, but a useful one. Okay, so some Quakers in Britain hold that view, that it's useful to have a God, but it's not that God's real in any kind of a way. Okay. So for them, if you look across at the evangelical or the conservative tradition, you know, this view of God that's real and you can say all kinds of things about the nature of God, well, that's, you know, either inappropriate, unnecessary, or just plain wrong. So for those people. Most Quakers in Britain are what I would call semi-realist. Okay. So, in other words, God is real, but statements about God may not be true necessarily. And in fact, it's quite difficult to come up with a totally true statement about God. Okay, so there is a God, or there's something beyond the material, but actually trying to define it or characterize it in words is really rather a difficult kind of thing to do, and an inappropriate thing to do. And I just want to dwell on that in a way. So within semi-realism, beliefs, any beliefs that people hold, may be sort of true, but only true personally, or provisionally, for a short time, or partially. They're certainly not true for all people, for all time, you know, for everybody. So, and it's based on the idea that human language cannot get close to the reality of God. God is beyond language. So spiritual experience is bigger than our human language can really cope with or handle. So, here's a quote. Statements about God are better approached as models rather than truths. Since no ultimate truth can be known, religion is about commitment rather than belief. So it refers back to this idea as well that within the liberal tradition there's a huge variety of beliefs. But actually it doesn't matter too much because belief isn't the most important thing. The experience is important, but let's not try and pin it down too much with words. So these semi-realists are not undermining the existence of God or something. We have to say or something because they might not even want to say God because that's maybe too specific. But they are just saying when we come to talk about it, it's rather tricky and not the best use of our time necessarily. And this fits in with the very permissive belief system we find in British Quakerism. So if you ask Quakers about God, you'll get various answers and various personal interpretations about what people experience in the silence of worship. So, okay. And I just want to go through this in a little more depth. So, now just to remind you, when liberal Quakerism, this kind of Quakerism we find here, was set up about 100 years ago and became dominant within Britain, it was a reaction to the evangelical Quakerism that had gone before it in Britain and to the Quakerism that had gone before that, which was the Quakerism where people were wearing the hats and the uniforms and were holding on to a very pure expression, as they saw it, of Quaker faith. These 20th century Quakers wanted a faith that moved with the times, that was open to new ideas, and they adopted an idea that actually people knew more about God in each age. So the, you know, the further history goes on, the more people will know about God. So in other words, a sense of continuing revelation, but also a kind of chronological authority that people will necessarily know more in 2010 than they would have done in 1910. So it basically means that tradition is forever moving, ever on the move. And as we saw, that has been picked up largely in the 20th century with this shift from a purely Christian Quakerism to a very permissive and broad Quakerism, where Quakers may be Christians or not Christians now. So, silence, though, remains highly valued in the liberal tradition. It's still the basis of worship, still the means to the experience, the means to the encounter with whatever and however you want to describe that. And because it still works, it then has an authority. So people go into the silence, hopefully experience something. This gives authority to the method as well as to belief. Basically, silence is then used in Quaker business meetings as well. So when Quakers make decisions, which they do without votes, silence is the basis of those business meetings. There'll be an item put forward, people will consider it in silence, there'll be ministry on it. Eventually, there'll be a reflection of where the meeting's got to, maybe with some more silence, and then consent or otherwise. Basically, whenever Quakers want to do anything, collectively, they're likely to use silence as one of the means to do it, particularly to discern decisions. So it's very, very important. It runs through the life of Quakerism. And there is a postcard you can buy that says, "I am a Quaker. In case of emergency, please be silent." And it's very funny, but it's also true, because where else would you go? You know, in an emergency, of course, you go to the means, to the experience of encountering God. So, okay. Now, what happens is silence is then elevated. Silence becomes very, very important. And as with early friends, the value of speech is diminished. You know, speech is a little bit suspect. It's less important, in a way, in worship than silence. And as with the early friends, any speech in meeting for worship and into the silence is meant to help bring people deeper into their worship experience. So, and there's this idea that, here's a nice quote: "God cannot be fitted into preformed notions bounded by expression in words. Faith must allow for elements of radical unknowability." So collectively, Quaker theology is quite minimal in some ways. For some people, silence is a more accurate response to difficult questions. So, and liberal Quakers have moved away from being either, you know, text-centric or even from any sense of oral tradition, because of this, the value they put on silence. So, here's another quotation: "For many of us, I feel sure, putting God into words at all is to trivialize the very thing we're seeking to convey. The silence of meeting means so much to me. Where else can I go to share with others what is beyond words?" things. So again, there's definitely something there to experience, but it's not easily talked about, and it may be better or more authentic to keep quiet about it. Now, what's happened partly through this emphasis on silence is that the diversity that we find in belief has grown without people necessarily realizing it. Because you can go into a Quaker meeting, you might sit there for an hour, there may be two or three ministries, but maybe no one will say anything. Or if they do offer ministry, it may not be theologically explicit. It may be much more about values or witness or whatever. So you may not find out anything about what your neighbor actually believes. And of course, that doesn't matter because it's not really that important. But, you know, at some level, it has been of some concern to some friends that there's been this shifting kind of collection of beliefs that is unchecked and uncheckable. Nobody knows really what Quakers in Britain believe. Collectively, they say very little. Personally, of course, everyone has a theology because we all want to make sense of, you know, whatever the mystery is. We all try and work out some explanation to help us. But because of the semi-realism, we wouldn't imagine that it would be true for anyone else. So this would be my God, or my version, or my understanding of the mystery. But I wouldn't expect you or you to have the same version, or for me to think that mine is right or the only right way. So there has been a period, probably in the late 80s, early 90s, where Quakers were actually rather nervous about saying what they believed, in case in this broadening group they actually trod on someone's toes or found themselves on the margins. So, for example, as there were Quakers who were not Christians, then was it okay to be a Christian? Was it okay then to say that you were a Christian? Or would you suddenly find yourself in a minority? And I think Quakers in Britain have come through that period and actually much more able now to say, well, this is how I understand my religious experience. And I can say that with integrity, and I hope you can hear it. And, you know, there is a greater sense of agency now. So, but certainly there was a time where things were slightly hidden and unsure. And it's only at the moments where friends want to adopt a new book of discipline or have to collectively agree a theological statement that then these things sometimes emerge. So, now, for people in the other traditions, this all looks very strange, because they're very clear about their theology. It's right at the front of their books, and that's often quite short statements, just giving a clear description of what a Quaker believes. And they look across at these liberal friends, think, these people are rather strange. Some of them are not Christian, and a lot of them don't want to say anything very much at all about God. So, and in fact, the British book, this is the British Quaker Faith and Practice. It's the regularly revised book of discipline for British Quakers. In 1921, the section on doctrine was replaced by illustrative spiritual experiences. So doctrine is replaced by experience. And as a result, this book has got fatter, because there's lots more experience to describe and illustrate. So you might expect it to get bigger in the future. As we said 2 weeks ago, it's liberal friends are not held together by what they believe. Right? You know, what do Quakers believe is not a central question for British friends. Rather, they'd be held together, find unity in the way in which they approach experience, by the way they worship and do business, the means to experience. So, however, there is also another aspect which binds Quakers together very much, and it's not what they believe, but how they believe. And it's just to go back to this idea of being forever open to new ideas and new revelation. And this is moved from an idea almost to a prescription, that the authentic mode for a modern British Quaker is to be seeking. So, you know, people's theologies, personal theologies will change over time. What's important is the search, not so much the finding. Because the finding often gets put into formulas which appear inauthentic. Or just the very idea that you may find is not appropriate. So in other words, all of Quaker theology in the British liberal tradition is about perhapsness. Okay, it's about being towards, forever towards, hopefully always closer, but never totally there. So British Quakers are forever trying to get closer, but they don't actually believe it's possible to be totally there. That would be inauthentic, inappropriate position to hold. And the slight paradox about this is that British Quakers are absolutely sure about this. So they're absolutely sure that you can only ever be perhaps. Okay? And it's partly that liberal Quakerism was set up on a rational basis. So rationally, British Quakers know that any kind of God talk's a little bit awkward. I was brought up an atheist, and I mean, it was very clear that all of that was very suspect and didn't make any sense at all. You know, it wasn't like true or false, it was just meaningless. People to be talking about, you know, a kind of God that was like a father but not like a father. I mean, it just rationally, philosophically, doesn't make any sense. And from that kind of rational place, liberal Quakers are sure that within the spiritual journey, you can only ever be perhaps in terms of your theology. So all theology is a perhaps kind of exercise. Now, I've called this the absolute perhaps. It's a kind of paradox. That's how friends in Britain work. They're absolutely certain that they can only ever be uncertain. And that's a very different position from many people in other churches who sometimes may leave out some of the certainties. For example, you know, Anglicans who might leave out some of the words of the creed because they're no longer comfortable or appropriate for them. So for those people, they're uncertain of the certainties of their church. Quakers are forever certain they can only be uncertain. It's a reverse kind of process. And we'll come on to ecumenism next week, but it does also mean that ecumenically, whilst Quakers are very keen to work with people of, you know, other Christians and people of other faiths on lots of joint projects, that there's a little bit in the British Quaker psyche that is suspicious of other groups who think that they've found it for all time, or that they have the final answer. So, because that somehow just doesn't sit very easily with the liberal Quaker idea of theology. It also means liberal Quakers are then a little bit suspect to these other Quakers who think they've found it. And we'll come back to Quaker-Quaker relations in 2 weeks' time, because they're both a little bit suspect of the other. So, but for liberal British Quakers, all religious groups have to be at least partly wrong theologically. So, okay. What we can see here, though, again, as we've seen in previous weeks, is innovation over time. Not surprising, but it's just come out in different ways in the three main traditions of Quakers that we find around the world today. But I have focused on the British one in particular because that's the one we live amongst here. Okay. So, a little bit shorter than usual, but time for questions and comments, if anyone has them. Yes, please. No, sure. Oh, okay. Right. That was actually an article in The Friend, which is the Quaker Weekly, in 1990. So Jonathan Hewitt actually wrote that. But, yeah. Yes, did you?
I was talking about the Universalist. Mm-hmm. Whether they include semi-realists and
Okay, thanks. So the question was about universalist Quakers and whether they're realist, non-realist, semi-realist. So universalist Quakers are those who feel there are many different paths to God, which I suspect is now a majority position amongst British Quakerism anyway. But this group was particularly vocal in the 1980s during a debate about whether Quakers needed to be Christian or not. And then there was a wonderful piece was written by people on both sides of the debate saying, well, it's both and. You know, you can be both Christian and universalist. And, you know, so, but they could actually be anything, actually, because, I mean, you could hold that view in a realist place or a semi-realist or a non-realist. Some of them will be non-realists, but most probably would be semi-realists. So, but there's nothing implicitly, you know, to hold them to any one of those positions within their universalism. I mean, it's basically there are many different paths to God. Ralph Hetherington, who was a leading universalist writer, said that he would support any sincerely held belief except fundamentalism, which, of course, he's also very sincerely held. But it's more the perhapsness, I think, that they're sitting alongside. That there's something too final about many forms of fundamentalism, you know, that proves problematic. So although I joke that some liberal Quakers are kind of fundamentalist about being perhaps. And there is a paradox as well for the non-realists, just to go back to these people who think God is a fiction, because they're also very certain about that. And sometimes they're in tension with the rest of British Quakers, and not because of what they believe, but because of the zeal and certainty with which they believe it. So if they said, you know, for me, God is a fiction, then that's totally, well, I mean, you know, it's a valid position. But when they say, God is a fiction and you need to know that, that's a problem. Because they're very sure about that, and it's as if they have the truth for all people, for all time, and that doesn't sit very easily in British Quakerism at the moment.
But surely all you can say is, for me at this moment,
absolutely,
God is fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Or equally, for me at this moment, God is real.
Yes.
But that is all that anybody can say.
Well, that would be if you were a seeking Quaker, that's what you would say. But, you know, people in other churches, would hold a position with greater clarity. So they would say, you know, no, this is how it is. Okay.
If you look at quite a lot of early friends, they talk about where God is revealed,
mm-hmm,
in that inner encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I'm interested in is the claims of revelation often expressed and formalized in scripture,
mm-hmm,
of religion.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense of the study on its own,
mm-hmm,
revelation in a religious tradition. But can I offer it for any comments that relate to what you've actually
said? Well, the early friends are very certain. They're realists. I mean, they're very certain about what they've experienced and the best way to describe it. So for them, theology is true. They're very clear about it. In fact, about 10 years from the beginning, this Quaker John Perrott comes back. He's been imprisoned in the Vatican, but he comes back and he says, "I've had new revelation. I may have mentioned this before, but God's told me that we shouldn't just take our, you know, why do we take our hats off in worship? Why don't we take our shoes off in prayer? That's equally scriptural. And why do we meet at fixed times? We need to meet together when led to by the Lord." And George Fox said, "No, John, we've had our dispensation. We've had our revelation." So there's a very different sense. They've been given a very clear understanding of the right relationship between humanity and God. And it's not then up for picking and choosing and changing here and there. So early friends are very clear. They're more, in that sense, they're more like the evangelical tradition today than the liberal one. The liberal one always turns out to be the most innovative. In some ways, it just looks the same because of the silent worship. So. Okay, let's see.
Okay. But for the
non-realists,
those that read their own
notes,
what
are
they doing with their silent meditation?
Yes. Well, for many of these people, God is a useful aspiration. It's a sort of God represents what humanity can aspire to. And I mean, this is a position that Feuerbach had back in the 19th century, that that sort of political idealism can be represented by God. So, I mean, there's plenty of, you still might want to be getting your life in right ordering and aligned correctly with this aspiration, or you may be wishing at least to take some time to reflect on that. But it is a very different position from, it's certainly not meeting for worship, as it's still called. So, and within business meeting, it becomes even more difficult, where traditionally Quakers have met in silence to discern the will of God. Well, the will of God becomes the will of a useful fiction or the will of, useful aspiration. So, again, I suppose it would be about seeking the best way forward, but using silence as the means. So it is quite a radical departure, and there is an ongoing discussion about it, really, within British Quakers and about, just where it sits. Yes, please.
You were taught last time and also today about the Quaker assumption that as time moves on, we know more and more about God.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just explain a bit more about that. Mm-hmm. Is that something which came with the very early Quakers?
No. Again, it's a 20th century innovation in amongst the liberal tradition. So, because as I said, that example before where John Perrott came back and said, well, how about shoes and not hats? And George Foote says, no, we've been given this. So, and generally, even though Quaker theology has changed over time considerably, each group thought that they had it right for that moment. And it wasn't that, they thought they had it more right, but it wasn't that they somehow believed necessarily they would be changing all the time. And so what happens with this idea, which is called progressivism, is that there's an innate sense. I mean, it's inherent that you will know more in 50 years, and so therefore things may change.
And you'll know more, not what you think will be different.
That's right. Yes, absolutely. You will know more. Humanity knows more about God's will in each age, necessarily. God reveals God's self more across time. So, I mean, you with that new knowledge, if you get it, you will necessarily change. Not that you can, but you will and should. So they would also be critical of, George Fox in 1660 saying, no, we've been given it. Yeah. But it's a 20th century idea for Quakers. But most Quakers today would think that it goes back to the early days, because of course the early friends were still trying to lead every day as if guided by God. So there's this sense of being wanting continual guidance, but not on the big picture, just in terms of, well, do I do this or do I do that? And many of the things were given to them, in one go, really. But in, for example, there's a 1931 statement, be open to new light, and this has become almost sort of a catchword for modern British Quakers. And people are surprised when they hear it's only from 1931, because it's, it feels like it should be George Fox saying that. So. Okay, can we go here and then?
You talk about worship as being something which is open. The uncertainties that
are
part of it.
Yes.
How does this relate to this concept of right ordering and the structure of the organization,
mm-hmm.
which seems to be a kind of contradiction?
Okay, thank you. So the question there was about the openness of worship contrasted with the fact there's a very clear sense of how you worship and how you minister. Most ministries in meeting are less than 3 minutes long, and there's a particular kind of style that's often associated. with it. And there's this phrase called right ordering, which refers to the right way that Quakers need to do things, the right way that God's people need to act. Oh, okay. Right, I see. Well, I'll just do insight. I mean, one of the things about insight is that some of the rules and codes are actually to protect the means to experience. So there's not a rule that you need to minister for less than 3 minutes. But I guess friends are aware that if there's too much talk in the meeting, the openness, the space for encounter disappears. And so people are encouraged to be brief and to the point. It's also difficult to listen and really hear for more than 3 minutes. You're all doing amazingly well. Now outside, though, friends talk about taking what they're given in meeting for worship out into their daily lives. I mean, we need to remember that initially worship was a moment of intentional collectivity. But these early Quakers were filled with this sense of accompaniment. And they went through the whole of their lives accompanied by God. So they didn't necessarily need to go to worship to sort of be, fueled up for the week. They would be there, but worship would help. Some Quakers, they would still talk about that continual sense of accompaniment, which they take with them into worship. And so right ordering both comes out of really the relationship with God, which hopefully is affirmed and enhanced by worship, but ideally would be there anyway. So that helps.
I can see why your contrast in definition about the theology with other Christians, let's say Christian.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking when there's a sign of God's beyond language, the phrase of God in a beckoning word came to mind.
Yes.
And that's one that's often used in the tradition. Within the mainstream.
Sure. Yes.
And I think there's enough of a sort of, battle, but opposite way of interpreting things.
Yes, sure.
Traditions.
Yes. Thank you for that. Because, there's actually very little that's totally unique to Quakerism, and it's useful to point that out. And it's more that the way it's been put together historically and the emphasis that certain things are given. So, one of the ways to think about Quakers is as mystics, in a sense, emphasizing the encounter and connection with God. But what's interesting in this discussion is then the very strong emphasis that is put on God being beyond words, to the point that there is no creedal formulation, no regular vocal confession of faith. That's just not part of Quaker worship. And it's such, a Quaker meeting worship is such a stark contrast with its circle of chairs and no front and no outward forms, because it's based on that idea, I suppose. So it's just that the final, the ultimate emphasis comes out in a different place. And the debates are about different things then. So, yeah. But thank you for pointing out Craig's art. Totally unique. So. Okay. Yes, please.
How would 20th century
picking and choosing? Oh, I see. Well, they might say that's all we can do in some ways is try and find a set of words that's faithful to our experience. I spent quite a lot of time interviewing Quakers about what they believed, and certainly people would say that it changed for them over time, and so they had very different kinds of relationships with different kinds of gods, even across time. But it is a difficulty for a group that isn't tied to a text, or in fact isn't even tied to its own book. In 20, 30 years or 10, 15, this will be revised and, may change radically. So, it's also a difficulty for a group that places so much emphasis on an interior experience. How do you know you're right? How do you know anything? And of course, one of the charges against Quakers has been, you're just imagining it. You know, and that, I mean, what's interesting though is that's exactly what the early friends are worried about. Die to yourself, to your desires and imaginations. They're somehow aware, very aware of that tension, and yet argue that having a form of outward words or a set form of beliefs won't necessarily help. You could be lulled into, you know, just repeating them regularly and still be prey to your desires and imaginations and notions. So it's a constant challenge, I think, but not just for Quakers. It may be more so for Quakers because there's nothing actually to remind them ever now in the British tradition about what they're about. If you have a meeting for an hour with no ministry and nothing anywhere that, you know, I mean, the challenge is that you don't spend an hour thinking about your lunch. But what you find is that people don't do that, actually. You find that people do find something very deep and meaningful and purposeful in the silence, time and time again, and it comes right. Now, then they may just pick and choose, you know, but actually that doesn't matter too much because it's the experience that matters, not the way it's described. So they may have trouble refuting that accusation, but they could also say, well, it's not the most important thing. So. Yes.
You have the desire to know or to be anything and sink down.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually that unless you've actually done that, then you can test whether in fact you're being
right. Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that's the other image that relates very much to it. It's part of an experiment of actually sort of getting avocados to grow. And realizing what happens to the seed, powerful things are, and how before anything starts to go out upwards from the seed, it goes down, and then splits, right in half,
before everything else to come.
It's actually very powerful. Grow avocado.
Right, Quakers are avocados, basically. So, thank you. So, yes, I mean, there is this sense of... I mean, one of the challenges as well, of course, is that after the first generation of Quakers, you've got people who are coming to the movement attracted by the ideas, but waiting for that experience of sinking down. You know, and today in a Quaker meeting, you'll find some people have very strong sense of spiritual experience in their lives, and others who are still hoping and waiting, but feel that this may be the best place to seek. And so there is a mix in that sense as well. Yeah. Yes, please.
The creedal statements in written form have been unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
Why have the written testaments been so important?
Okay. The question now is, if written creeds have been a difficulty for Quakers, why haven't written testimonies? Well, there isn't actually a set of written testimonies. I mean, testimony really sort of the consequence of the spiritual life. It's the outward life. Now, there are various statements that have become associated with Quaker history, such as the statement that Quakers presented to Charles II in 1661, saying we utterly deny all outward wars, etc., etc. But that isn't the peace testimony. That's just an expression of that testimony against war and preparation for war. So there isn't actually a set of a formula. And of course, over time, where Quakers are witnessing has changed, becoming now Quakers don't wear grey and don't use thee and thou. That part of Quaker testimony has disappeared because it's no longer seen to be so important. So actually, there isn't a tension there because there haven't been a set of written testimonies. Yeah.
I'm thinking of what's the difference between non-realists and secularists, humanists, or non-realists and atheists?
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So, question is, what's the difference between non-realists and atheists or secular humanists? The difference is that non-realists think that God is a useful idea. So they're not totally opposed to religion. In fact, they would invent religion if it didn't exist, because they think it's quite useful to have an idea of God which helps humanity aspire to its greatest values. But it's an instrumental maneuver. It's, you know, it's a strategic plan. Now, atheists obviously would think that would be a crazy idea. I mean, you know, the whole idea of God's crazy. I gave a talk once to a group of humanists about Quakers, and they say Quakers, you know, often for them the most dangerous people because of this lack of creeds and things like this. They look almost reasonable. So, you know, they're sort of worried about Quakers. But I mean, they wouldn't want there to be a Quakerism, ideally. You know, because it's just another form of religion, which is another form of fiction, you know, another form. It's not a useful fiction, it's just a fiction. Okay, well, I think that was someone beeping 7 o'clock. So we should close there. We'll be back next week looking at Quakers and ecumenism and how it first became possible for Friends, because they weren't always very ecumenical. And then the week after that, we'll look at the future of Quakerism. So thank you very much. I'll stay around for a few minutes in case anyone has any other questions. And as usual, I have put some leaflets out on the side. If you find them helpful, please do take them.